Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is the science writer Michael Brooks. Michael holds a PhD in quantum physics, and as well as authoring several popular science books, including The Secret Anarchy of Science, the best-selling 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, and At the Edge of Uncertainty, he's also written a novel, Entanglement. In addition, he's a journalist and broadcaster. He regularly writes for The Guardian. He's a former feature editor of The New Scientist magazine and writes a weekly column for The New Statesman. Michael's here today to talk to us about the state and role of science today, how one goes about doing good science, some pitfalls to avoid, and what the future may hold for this fascinating field of human endeavour. Hello, Michael. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Could we start off by you maybe telling us a bit about your background and what first sparked your interest in science?
Yeah, so like many people who are in science, it was a teacher who kind of made it happen for me. So, you know, when I was at school, when I was 15, 16, I could have gone into humanities as easily as going into science, I would have said. And I just happened to have a physics teacher who was extraordinary, a guy called Mr. Sumner. I remember him well. And he just, but what really engaged me about him wasn't necessarily the science itself. It was the way that he presented it as something that people do, you know. So it was very much like, you know, this is what we're doing, say, with nuclear reactors. What do you think? You know, should we be doing this? And it would allow us to have debates in the classroom about nuclear physics or whatever. And suddenly this became, you know, it wasn't just about solving equations. It wasn't just about sort of learning how to pass an exam. It was about, you know, this is something that is a useful thing for us to talk about in terms of, you know, human life. Yeah, what do we want to do with this stuff? Yeah. And for me, that's when I really got into science, was when I, you know, I just sort of saw it as this amazing kind of, you know, potential. It was like a pool full of potential. You could do anything you wanted with it, but you had to think about it first. That was what he really, you know, got across to me. And I think I've always sort of, you know, loved that side of science. You know, it's interesting to be able to do it and to do the mechanics of it and solve equations or whatever. But actually, to kind of put it to work is find the right way to put it to work, I think, is really fascinating.
If you were going to pin down what science means to you, then, I mean, you've alluded to that to an extent there, but what is it, and why do you think it is so important?
So, what does it mean to me? I mean, that's a good question. It's so sort of ingrained and embedded in who I am and what I do that I sort of rarely stop and think, you know, what does it actually mean to me? If somebody said to me, you know, you're not allowed to think scientifically anymore, I just wouldn't even know how to, you know, I don't know how to think like other people sometimes think. You know, I have friends who are into astrology or whatever, and, you know, we'll go and see a medium, and I can't get my head around that kind of thing. And so for me, that it's a way of approaching the, you know, your whole world, where you kind of try and work out what something really is, as opposed to maybe what it looks like, and you apply it to, you know, you might apply it to the way you educate your children, you might apply it to the way you think about your own health. You know, I think I have quite a scientific approach to my health, for instance, where, you know, if something is going wrong, I don't sort of immediately throw up my arms in panic and say, I must go and see a doctor. Usually I'll Google and I'll think and I'll think about symptoms and evidence and symptoms and cause and effect. And that's just a scientific way of thinking. So I think it ends up permeating everything once you sort of trained in this. And then it's really hard to think. And this is an important point, actually. It's really hard to think about how other people think when they don't have science as something sort of major in their lives. And I think that's the cause of a lot of the, you know, things like, you know, Richard Dawkins and these kind of conflicts that come up. It's because he has no ability to conceive of what it's like to be not Richard Dawkins.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a really important thing for him to realise.
Yeah. Okay. Your books appear, in part at least, to be an attempt to bring science to a more general audience. Would you say that's a fair point?
Yeah, absolutely. When I'm writing, I'm certainly not writing for even, you know, the readers of, say, New Scientist. I want to write for people who would never pick up a science book. And that's the best, you know, kind of accolade I ever get, is when somebody says, oh, I normally hate science books, but actually I really like yours. And I had a few people say that, you know, on, say, 13 things that don't make sense. You know, they said it was like it wasn't even a science book. And that's great for me. I love that because the last thing I want to kind of do is preach to the choir, and which is why, you know, some of my books really annoy some scientists as well and sort of really get me into trouble from, you know, those who wish we didn't say, you know, talk about the things that the scientists don't get yet. For instance, but so I very much sort of think of myself as writing really probably for a 16-year-old, you know, school student.
Uh-huh. Do you see yourself in a similar way what you're doing in books, what say Brian Cox is doing on the telly?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a very different audience with books and with television, and the difference as well is that, of course, I, you know, I get control over how it's presented, you know, that right to the end of it. So I'm in a position where I can say, oh, okay, you know, this is what I want to say. This is how I'm going to tell this story. This is how I'm going to explain this thing. And, you know, ultimately, you know, me and the editor of the book, you know, that's our decision. I think with TV, you've got a lot more layers in between over what you can cover, what you can't, you know, how things get presented. And I think in some ways he has to aim even wider than I do. So he's aiming for people who just, you know, might be watching TV. Whereas, you know, I think if you pick up a book and start to read it, that puts you in a small minority of people.
Just sticking on this theme for one more thing, I'm thinking of Bill Bryson's book, A Short History of Nearly Everything. I mean, you hear so many people who are involved in science picked up that book when they were a teenager, and that really turned them onto science.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he has a real gift, doesn't he? I mean, I don't think I should compare myself. We don't belong in the same sentence, really. He's one of those people that just has this sort of almost miraculous common touch where, you know, everybody just loves, you know, the way that he writes, the way that he phrases things, the way he presents, you know, and he does that brilliant thing of presenting himself as a complete ingenue. You know, he's never come across this before, and it blows his mind, and you know, you get to be inside his mind while it's blown. You know, that's a real gift. So, it's a similar thing, but I think he does it a lot better.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think you're all doing a great job just coming at it from different angles, really.
I think that's true. I mean, I have to come at it from where I am, which is, you know, I'm not Bill Bryson. You know, I have a background in science, and I do understand what scientists are doing. It doesn't blow my mind, and I'm also more questioning of it than he is, certainly. Yeah. So his approach would be to kind of say, oh, this is the amazing stuff that scientists are doing, and you kind of get that sort of scientist with a capital S, and I try to avoid that. You know, I think their, you know, their pitfalls and their problems ought to be highlighted as well.
Sure, yeah. Like you mentioned in your education that you nearly went and studied the humanities. I don't know if this is your opinion or something, but it sometimes appears that science is becoming more and more specialised at school, that kids only do scientific subjects and that they don't get a balance of the arts or the humanities. Do you think they should play a certain part in a scientific education?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's a major failing, certainly of our education system in the UK, is that, you know, you have children who have no idea what they want to do with their life. They don't know what they want to do next week or in the summer holidays, and they're being forced to make decisions about who they are. So they're effectively being told at age 13, 14, right, you now must decide whether you are a scientist kind of person or whether you're going to be, you know, somebody who studies languages or somebody who does English. You know, everybody has to do English, but there's this, and everybody has to do, you know, science to a degree, but there's this sense of which, you know, you have to almost join a certain tribe at a certain point. And I think that's really, really dangerous because, you know, you change in those years. You know, you change between the age of 13 and 18 and, you know, 80. And there's no need to put kids into boxes that early on. And having a good grounding in education in the humanities is a fantastic thing for a scientist. As you see with the likes of Peter Medawar, for instance, you know, you have these kind of old school scientists, as it were, who used to be just, you know, great classic scholars and great, you know, really well read and, you know, really understood literature and I think that always came across in the way they interacted with the public. It came across in the way they wrote about science. And I sort of see a dearth of that. So what you have now is, you know, the trend in books, for instance, is that you'll have a scientist who writes about his field and his discoveries and his take on that very small thing. And it's never sort of, you know, given any context in terms of this is how it fits with society. And these are the groups that don't agree with me. And these are the people who don't like what I do. And let's, how do we deal with that? You know, it's very much just, you know, me and my very narrow specialism. I think we have a very, I think we're sort of raising a generation of quite blinkered scientists in some ways, and that does bother me.
Sure. And what about, for example, the skills of critical thinking or philosophy, where they are skills where you practice working on your assumptions? Presumably that would be very helpful as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can get a long way in science without any of that. and probably the less of that you have, the further you'll go. You know, it's the self-doubting kind of, you know, am I questioning my own assumptions, is not really the way, you know, to winning grants and, you know, gaining professorships and everything else, you know, because academia is now so competitive, you know, full of conflict. There's a lot of difficulty. You know, the thing that you have to do is get on, get your head down and publish and publish and publish. And there's not really much room for sort of sitting back and thinking about the bigger picture of why you're doing what you're doing, whether you're, you know, on the right track, whether you should switch fields, for instance, you know, whether actually people are mining an ever smaller amount of resources and it's time to get out. You know, you just don't have time to think like that these days. And I think that's a real problem. I think that just means we end up sort of grinding out smaller and smaller discoveries of less and less significance until people are bored with what science is producing.
So what strategies would you suggest then to avoid confirmation bias? For example, in one of your books, you mentioned Richard Feynman's suggestion that the first principle is you must not fool yourself. And you are the easiest person to fool. Is that a good starting point?
It is. I mean, I think, you know, it's always healthy if you have a perspective, and I struggle with this, as my wife will tell you, to have a perspective where you say, right, I'm probably wrong about this, but here's what I think. You know, everybody forgets the first bit, and they just say, well, here's what I think. Yeah. You know? And actually, you know, good science will tell you that you start off with, you're probably wrong, but here's where I'm starting out from, and I'm going to sort of look at the evidence and see which way it pulls me or pushes me, or, you know, what I have to sort of throw away because it's clearly wrong. There's not a lot of that self-doubt taught, I think, you know, and I think the structure of the way we do science, and certainly academic science now, is that you just have to be thrusting and positive and this is what I'm doing, this is where I'm going, this is what I expect to get out of it kind of thing. And I just don't think we're as reflective as we used to be.
Yeah. Isn't what you said earlier on there, isn't that in a sense also fundamental for creativity? This almost comfort to be able to make mistakes and not be afraid to make them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the most important thing you do is play around and experiment and be willing to discard something. The Nobel Prize winner, André Geim, who developed graphene, won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago for physics. He characterizes his research as sort of playing around and failing, you know, doing lots of experiments that fail. And then he says occasionally you'll get one that fails to fail. And that's, you know, that's a success.
Brilliant.
And he said those are, you know, very satisfying, but very rare. But of course, you know, that means you've got time and space to be playing around it, and failure is okay. And I think that one of the problems with the pressure on people to publish now is that you very rarely publish something that failed. You tend to publish things that succeed. So you set yourself easier and easier targets, I think, a lot of the time. And that can be problematic in terms of doing something risky and creative that nobody else has done before. You know, Geim also says that, you know, you shouldn't do anything that's sort of on the beaten path. You've got to go off and find something that nobody else is doing. And, of course, that's risky.
Yeah. Do you think, this is the same thing, really, but do you think in order to do good science, it is important to take the sceptical argument seriously?
Well, that you're wrong, you're probably wrong.
Well, that we are, you know, limited in time and space. Our cognitive abilities are finite, our senses are finite too, or...
Yeah, I think it's worth having those in the back of your mind. I don't think it's possible to go out and do really good science if those are in the front of your mind, because you just end up in a position where you just won't believe anything and say, oh, I'm probably, you know, probably fooling myself. So in some ways I'm contradicting what I said earlier, but I think, you know, you've got to live in the real world, just as, you know, if you're running a business that's marketing some product or other, And you might have your doubts about that product, and you might think it's the best I've come up with. I think it's probably the best on the market. But if you go out and try and sell it on the basis that, well, it might not be as good as I'm saying it is, you know, you won't get anywhere. And I think it's the same with science. I think, you know, once you've decided that this is worth pursuing, then you have to design experiments and design, you know, research strategies that take you in some direction, but always with the willingness to, you know, to discard it if it's not working out. But I think, you know, that's the hardest part, that willingness to discard it when you've, you know, put 2 years or 10 years or 20 years of your life into it. That's very difficult, and I don't think any human being does that very easily at all.
But on that point, when you think of lots of fields of human endeavour, science has those, at least theoretically, those skills to make judgments in a more provisional way. Science, the inductive way of doing things, is based on probability, in the sense that you're open to being wrong. And
But I think one of the real strength of science, if you like, is the fact that you don't do it in a vacuum. So you don't do it and it's just your science and then you publish it and everyone says, wow, you're so clever. You know, your colleagues in the sort of research community are there to kick you in the teeth at every opportunity. So, you know, so their job is to take what you've done and say, yeah, but, you know, here's a flaw, or it might not, this be a flaw. And they kind of pull it apart like unraveling a jumper. And if they can't pull it apart, and if it all stays whole, then you know you've done something really good. Yeah. Doesn't mean it's right, because, you know, there are limits to it, even, you know, what your critics are able to discern. Yeah. But that's the strength of science, is that this community endeavor where everybody's kind of out to kick everybody else. And it's kind of, that's the accepted way of doing things, you know. So it's a very vicious, very brutal kind of area to work in, actually. And, you know, which is why you occasionally get sort of fist fights breaking out in physics departments. You know, because you've done all this work, you're pretty sure it's right. Somebody else comes in and it's kind of their job to ask difficult questions of it. And sometimes they go too far and are just out to get you for the sake of it, probably because you got the job that they wanted. So, you know, all kinds of human factors come into it. But at least that kind of, in some ways, when it's working well, and it doesn't always work well, it safeguards the process of, you know, building up our knowledge of how the world works.
What was it that Newton said, that he was stood on the, I can't remember the exact phrase.
On the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
I think he said this to Hooke, who was actually a dwarf. And I think it was, you know, some people interpreted it as a very barbed statement that he was, you know, he was actually sort of having a go at Hooke, as it were. But it's not been proven that he meant it in that kind of way. So, but Newton was one of the worst for kicking everyone else when they were down, you know, and he did the utmost that he could to stop other people sort of, you know, claiming any discovery that he thought he might have some claim on. So, he's a great example of how nasty scientists can be, I think.
But you also have wonderful examples of people being very generous. I'm thinking of Wallace with Darwin.
Yeah, exactly. We like to paint this kind of conflict narrative where, you know, it's always somebody pitted against somebody else, and, you know, Newton against Hooke or Newton against Leibniz. Or actually, the truth is, you know, of course, as in the world, you know, there are all kinds of very generous, outgoing, positive personalities as well. You know, for every Newton, there's a Wallace. You know, and Darwin himself was just a lovely, lovely guy. Clearly, you can tell from all of his writings and the way people spoke about him as well, and the fact that he never really kind of, you know, got on the bandwagon of promoting himself, but, you know, had other people sort of do it. Despite him, you know, he didn't necessarily want to be, you know, pushing himself in that way. And you get, you get all kinds of people, and you know, I come across some of them, you know, in sort of research that I'm doing. You just find people who are genuinely interested in the world, genuinely wanting to find out how it works, and genuinely positive if anybody makes a positive contribution to that. So, you know, not everybody's kicking everybody else.
I'm just going to ask you a question now about quantum physics. What evidence does that imply for the idea of uncertainty for you?
Well, I think sometimes it can be overgeneralized. So in quantum physics, there are genuine uncertainties, so that it's not possible to take a particle, for instance, say an atom. It's not possible to take it to know its momentum and its position exactly the same time. And that's, you know, that's the uncertainty principle. So there are combinations of things you can't know simultaneously.
Yeah.
I think people like to generalize this out somehow into some kind of principle of science, is that there is always uncertainty. And that is true, but that doesn't come from quantum physics, is the point I'm trying to make. So obviously in every measurement you ever make, you have a finite amount of certainty or finite sort of detail in your measurement. Every computation you make, you know, if you're using a computer, it will round something at some point. And so, you know, your computation is imprecise, from that perspective. And I think, scientists are generally pretty aware of where their limitations are in this. Certainly when they're doing their science, they know how, difficult the measurements they're making are. They know the limitations of their equipment. And they know that because they in 10 years time they hope to have something better. You know, scientists always hope to have something better to work with. So I think there is always uncertainty. And of course you get this in the classic kind of, you know, global warming debate, where people will say, oh, but you know, scientists say they can't be certain about this and that and the other. And the beautiful thing is that they actually know what they can't be certain about. And they know as well what those uncertainties are, roughly at least. I think scientists get painted a bit unfairly sometimes when they're, you know, either people say, oh, they think they're, you know, they know everything and they don't. Well, I don't think scientists do think they know everything. I think, no. You know, often their portrayal of things to the public can come across, you know, like they know everything. Sure. And they don't like to admit when they don't know something. But, you know, within themselves, I think all scientists are aware of the limitations that they work under.
Just staying with that point about climate change, the proof isn't conclusive or absolute, but nevertheless, it appears like the evidence is pretty overwhelming. I would suggest you could make a reasonable judgment that climate change, you know, is anthropomorphic. But in that regard, there's always going to be sort of gaps in evidence we have to make reasonable judgments about. What do you think makes a judgment reasonable?
That's a really good question, and I think this is where consensus comes in. So informed consensus, that is. So with climate change, you have something. I think it's 97% of climate scientists agree that we are doing stuff that is warming the planet, and nobody has a conclusive bulletproof proof that that is the case.
Yeah.
But when 97% of the experts are agreed that that is the case, then I think you can argue it's time to do something about it. And you know, and if we're causing it, then, you know, we're going to have to find the solution. I think it becomes like this gut consensus almost, where if enough people agree that this is probably true, then I think that becomes, you know, that leaps the gap, as it were. And that then for me becomes sort of irresponsible not to react to that. I think, you know, and what you find is the people who don't want to react to it are always the people with the vested interest in the status quo.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Okay. What impact do you think the philosophers Popper, Lakatos and Kuhn have had on scientific method?
I think they've had no impact whatsoever. The reason I say that is because although their work is fantastic and interesting, what they're doing is observing. And I don't think any scientists really change what they do on the basis of being observed by philosophers. So the scientific method, and there is no such thing as the scientific method. You know, people do all kinds of different things to do science.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a human endeavor, and it'll be done within the limitations of being human and being funded and having to publish and everything else. And you'll do what you need to do to get the job done. It's really interesting to read what they observe as, you know, as watchers of scientists. But I don't really think, especially because scientists don't really learn a lot of philosophy of science, and certainly not in any way that makes them react to it in their research careers.
Yeah.
So I don't think these people will have actually had any effect on the way science is actually done. Certainly not on a large scale. Maybe individuals who are interested and, you know, open to sort of questioning their activities might change them. But, I think being a philosopher of science is a very thankless task, really.
Do you think that the work, let's say, Danny Kahneman has done on cognitive biases in many ways suggests the same thing as Popper, that, you know, you need to question our rationality to an extent? Do you think that maybe because he's coming from a arguably more scientific background, that he might have a bit more of an impact than these philosophers?
I don't see it. I just don't see how, because, you know, it's a nice theory, isn't it, that you say, oh, you know, we're going to study these people who study, you know, how humans think, and that will change the way we do science. But actually, we do science in the only way we know how to do science, really, which is, you know, you kind of pick something you're interested in, kind of pick it apart and try and make sense of it in whatever way works for you. And so you're not really going to, you know, sit there and say, well, you know, Kahneman says I should be doing this, or Popper says I should be doing that. You'll do things in the way that you're trained to do them by your PhD supervisor, actually. I mean, that's the biggest influence you have, is the research environment in which you were trained, in which you're working. And I think what other people do in other people's labs, you know, it might be interesting, but it actually bears no relation to what, you know, what you're actually going to do yourself.
Okay, right, fine.
You're a cynic. Maybe I'm being too cynical, but I don't see it.
Yeah, fair enough. There appears to be an increasing amount of data from neuroscience to suggest that reason or rationality and emotion are not these two sort of separate dichotomous things. I'm thinking of the work of Antonio Damasio and Akon Johnson, etc. If that's the case, what implications may that have for the fact-value distinction that, you know, that is still arguably very present in much of scientific endeavour? For example, do you think undertaking the potential ethical implications of a new hypothesis should be taken into account before pursuing it?
I think it's a really interesting question. Again, I would say, as I've kind of, you know, nailed my colours to the mast in previous answers, really, I think people do it as a career. You know, so once you're in that as a career, you're not going to be derailed very easily by ethical considerations. You know, so you can argue, say, you know, my job, you know, that I'm paid for, that pays the mortgage, is to look for aliens. Okay, so I'm listening out for alien signals, and you probably think in your idle moments, I wonder what I'd do if I actually saw one. You know, and then you think, well, you know, maybe the reaction would be so extreme if we suddenly found ourselves, you know, in contact with aliens, that maybe we shouldn't look, and maybe we shouldn't do this. You know, maybe we shouldn't be looking for aliens. Maybe, I've certainly been in the room where people have argued a lot about whether we should be broadcasting signals for aliens to pick up. And these are sort of idle debates in some ways. I don't think they stop people doing the science. And you know full well that if you don't do it, somebody else will do it as well.
What, for example, also in the Terminator film, say some scientist was just on the verge of creating a Terminator, but also was aware that this Terminator could quite easily develop consciousness and decide to destroy the human race and potentially the planet itself. Could or should science be regulated? So before that scientist goes and pursues that research, it has to pass.
Yeah, but I think we already do that, you know, and we're in the middle of that nightmare with genetically modified organisms. You know, we haven't ever been able to really pursue them properly because of regulation and because of, you know, people saying, I don't like where this research is headed. And you know, we could argue the rights and wrongs of that, but that is the fact. And I think a lot of research is regulated. And, you know, we've had recently in the UK this thing with three-parent babies that's just gone through Parliament. And that's gone through a great deal of regulation, ethical sort of investigation. The scientists, I think, have actually been exemplary in that field of certainly, you know, all the way through with fertility treatments, etc., embryology, in terms of questioning whether they should do this, whether it's right to press ahead, and you know, self-regulating. So I think we do it. I think, you know, in fields like AI, it's more difficult. Artificial intelligence, you know, we're not at any point where danger is coming. You know, so I think, you know, we're having those arguments already, which is good. And we should be having those arguments. I don't think it's a dangerous technology yet. And of course, you know, we have it over sort of weapons and weaponization of technology. So, you know, nuclear armament and things like that. You know, we've been having this debate for 50 odd years. In the end, actually, you know, often it's the politicians who win rather than scientists, or who make the call rather than the scientists.
Would you say that's the same for Big Pharma? You know, that you often hear stories that research programs that are not successful, they don't get published, where you only get...
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's absolutely wrong. And there's a big campaign called the All Trials Campaign, where people are trying to get the pharmaceutical companies to publish all of their data, not just the stuff that makes them look good.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't want to have to repeat trials of things that don't work. And the way things are currently being published, that's what's happening. It's a massive waste and also, you know, dangerous because people are exposed to dangers they don't need to be exposed to. But that's not really a scientific issue. That's a policy issue and a politics issue. You know, the scientists themselves, you know, tend to be, in my experience, pretty ethical. You know, the ones I come across, they think hard about these kinds of things. But the, you know, the policymakers and businessmen and people who have to look after the bottom line of their company and please shareholders, that's a different story.
Sure, yeah, no, that makes sense to me, Michael. Are there any, in your view, any pervasive, unchallengeable dogmas within the scientific community at the moment? If so, which sacred cow seems likely to be the first to fall?
It's a really difficult one because I think it's a judgment call that, you know, I mean, to call something a sacred cow is, there's a difference between what people are willing to talk about publicly and privately.
Yeah.
So, and scientists are generally willing to speculate and, you know, challenge all kinds of things privately or in, you know, seminar rooms amongst colleagues. That, you know, they would present a united front over in public and say, you know, well, this is how it is. And you can argue the merits of that. I would say one area that I'm kind of looking at the moment is the whole sort of Big Bang cosmology thing, which for my money is just a little bit like the like Ptolemy's epicycles. You know, we have this lovely sort of narrative of how the Big Bang sort of, you know, was the start of everything. But actually, the laws of physics don't take us back there. You know, we know that relativity doesn't work with quantum physics. So the laws of physics we use to describe the universe and the laws we use to describe microscopic and high energy things, you know, they don't mesh together. So somehow there's another theory there. We have to deal with things like dark matter, which is this invisible, unknowable stuff that seems to fill the universe. And then there's dark energy, which is, you know, similarly, you know, a complete mystery. We have this idea called inflation, where the universe suddenly blew up, you know, hugely inflated itself very quickly just after the Big Bang. Nobody knows how or why it stopped. And these are all kind of things that have to be put into place to make the universe that we have work. You know, and this whole, the whole thing is known as the Big Bang cosmology. And actually, it's kind of full of holes. It's full of contradictions. It's full of things that don't really add up at all. But it's the best we've got. So on the one hand, you know, it's not like I can point the finger and say, well, you know, I've got a better theory, you know, but I can still look at that theory and say, you know what, that's the least satisfactory theory of the modern age, I would say. I think evolution tends to work really well, although we're discovering that environment makes an enormous difference to the genes and how they're expressed and things like that. So there's a lot more work to be done there. But, you know, I can't help thinking that in cosmology, in 100 or maybe 200 years' time, they're going to look back at us and laugh that we accepted this Big Bang idea.
And you said in one of your books recently that information theory might play a part in...
Yeah, so the idea is that, you know, but again, that's a very nebulous concept, and people who are working in this don't define it very well. But the idea is that somehow everything in the universe can be thought of as information. And we are, you know, by our actions and by the energies and interactions of physical things, you know, it's like a processing information. But this is a paradigm that people are talking in at the moment. And, of course, you know, we are in what we'd call the information age, you know, where we're all using computers. And we get, you know, we've only had computers since, you know, sort of, what, 50, 60 years ago, really. And so, of course, they've come to define a new way of thinking about how everything works. Just as when Newton was doing his work, you know, and everyone was obsessed by clocks, suddenly we had the clockwork universe then, and everything worked, you know, by this incredible sort of tight mechanism. And so, I think the information idea is really interesting. I'm not sure it's the final answer.
Yeah, okay.
It's our answer right now. It fits with our time, but I'm sure it won't last.
Sure. Okay, now in 2010, you launched the Science Party and stood for Parliament. Could you tell us something about that?
Yeah, I basically was put up to it by New Scientist. So it was one of, you know, it was an interesting way to cover the election. And we looked at the idea of, you know, are our politicians scientifically literate enough to make good decisions in the modern era. You know, we have all these kind of issues like energy and GM foods, you know, climate change, that we want them to be scientifically approached. You know, we think a scientific approach to them is good. Most of our MPs are not qualified in any way, you know, probably didn't even do science A-levels, you know, the vast majority of them. So they don't have a scientific way of thinking. They don't really know how to deal with evidence. They don't understand uncertainty. They like to be presented with, you know, a report that says, this is what, you know, the facts are, this is what you should do. And of course, science doesn't give you that. So the campaign was really an attempt to highlight the sort of scientific illiteracy, if you like, of MPs. And I chose one in particular, a guy called David Tredinnick, who is the MP for Hinckley and Bosworth. And he is pretty unscientific, I would say. You know, he's a believer in astrology, thinks homeopathy should be available on the NHS. He thinks that surgeons can't operate under a full moon because blood doesn't clot under a full moon, and all kinds of strange ideas, which, you know, are all out there in the general population. You know, there are plenty of people who have these ideas, but which is fine. You know, I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem when he's on, you know, the health and technology select committees and things like that. You know, he's in a position of influence and power, and I think that is the point where you want somebody there who knows what they're talking about.
Sure, yeah. Will you be standing again this time round?
No, I won't. Although I'm in contact with the Lib Dem sort of candidate for, you know, we're sort of talking together about ways in which we might get Mr. Chisinick out of Parliament, but I'm not standing myself now. And you know, my aim was never to get elected. You know, my wife told me if I got elected, I would be divorced within a month. Yeah. I didn't want to be married to an MP. Fortunately, the majority was pretty bulletproof, and there was no danger of that.
Okay, what is your understanding of the middle way, Michael, if any, and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, it's only, you know, I mean, I read a bit around you know, your website and, you know, philosophies, and I kind of, you know, I completely understand that. I think it's a very frustrating world where you're supposed to be tied to one particular, you know, extreme viewpoint. And so I'm very sympathetic to the ideas of the middle way, I have to say. And it's one of the huge problems I have. You know, if I go on some kind of broadcast media and they want me to come up with some concrete opinion, I'll usually end up equivocating and saying, well, you know, you could say this, but on the other hand, there's that, and we have to take into account all these things. Yeah. And so I find myself sort of, you know, I guess, you know, always sort of following the middle way. And there are. I mean, you know, we mentioned Brian Cox earlier. You know, he's very good at coming out with the sound bites that are completely, you know, actually untrue if you were to analyze them about, you know, the importance of science to British industry, for instance, or the importance of raising science and technology students to fill the workplace, because there's going to be all these sort of gaps in the workforce in 10 years' time, which suits the sort of science and technology lobby very nicely, but is not true. Yeah. So I find myself, you know, constantly annoying everybody. You know, when my book 13 Things That Don't Make Sense came out, there's a chapter on homeopathy in which I argued that the science on homeopathy really wasn't very well done, and that homeopathy was clearly, I think the word I used was bunkum, you know, clearly ridiculous. I'm not a believer in homeopathy at all, but science has not done a very good job in kind of disproving it. And I found myself hated by the homeopaths and hated by the scientists, you know, in equal measure. So I think, I, you know, that must put me very firmly in the middle way.
Right, yes, sure. And my last question, if people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
My website is michaelbrooks.org. My books are all listed there. So if you Google me, you know, you'll find all kinds of things that I've written. And on the New Statesman site, I have a weekly column that's all archived there. So everything I've written over the last 4 or 5 years is up there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Michael. It's been really enjoyable and fascinating.
You're welcome. I've enjoyed it too.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.